Hello and welcome back to another episode of Ballad to Talk About. It is Sunday, the 25th of September, 2022, and joining me as always is my co-host Sam. Hey Sam, how's everything going?
Yes, I'm very well. As we have talked about before on this podcast, I'm a big tennis fan, so obviously seeing the departure of Roger Federer from the tennis scene this week was upsetting, but here we are. We move on. How are you, Chen?
Yeah, it's the same thing, really. I can't believe that Roger Federer was the first tennis player I ever remembered that stayed in my consciousness. To see him retire, it's just kind of unfathomable. And it's such a nice picture of him and Rafa Nadal both bawling their eyes out at the end of their doubles match, isn't it?
I think they were probably crying because they had to sit and listen to Ellie Goulding afterwards. I think that was probably more like it.
Well, I'm sure they were crying over many things, but it is nice in sport to see two rivals who have dominated the sport for so many years in the end form a firm bond of friendship, which was very evident at the O2 Arena over this weekend. And for our slightly confused listeners, our introduction song this week was Lady Gaga's song 911. Now, not only is this because I chose this because, as I'm sure you know, Sam, I'm a huge Lady Gaga supporter, but it's also the fact that this is our 91st episode. So not quite the 911th episode, but in my books, that was close enough. Anyway, we cannot open this episode without briefly discussing what happened last Monday, which is the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II in London and in Windsor. And I'm sure we can both testify, Sam, that we both watched most of, at the very least some, but I suspect most of the funeral itself. So, Sam, what was the most impactful and memorable moment of that? I found it quite an emotional day, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it really was. I think it was sort of an end of an era, certainly for the UK, and I'm sure it was felt abroad. Well, I know it was felt abroad because you were telling me about it, but I've read estimates that the global television audience for the funeral was somewhere around 4 billion, which, one, is absolutely astounding for a global television audience, but two, just to illustrate the longevity of her reign, when she was born, the global population was 2 billion. So twice that have allegedly watched the funeral. And I think just thinking about that in itself is quite a moving statistic.
From a politics perspective, one of the most interesting one was she had 15 prime ministers over her tenure. Mm. The first was Winston Churchill. And I saw a stat, it wasn't told on the day of the funeral itself, but it just shows you the longevity of Queen Elizabeth II. Her first prime minister, of course, Winston Churchill, was born in 1874. And her final prime minister, Liz Truss, who she appointed 2 days before she passed away, was born in 1975, 101 years apart. So I think this is just amazing, really, to show you the impact she's had, not only in the UK, but across the world. And for me, the most impactful, memorable bit were two things. Firstly, the animals. I'm sure you definitely saw the nice picture of Emma, the horse, and the two corgis at Windsor. That certainly struck a chord, isn't it?
Oh, 100%, 100%. And I think, again, from a political perspective, what I did find funny is that the Queen has had 15 prime ministers. 7 of them were present at this funeral, which I think shows you how turbulent politics has been in the last few decades.
Yeah, 7 of them were there. You're right. That is really amazing. And the other thing that I have a lot of admiration for was the 8-person bearer party, who I'm sure had a lot of people with their hearts in their mouth to make sure that nothing was going to go wrong. Anyway, this is a politics and elections podcast. I'm sure you can spend much more talking about events in the UK and around in Europe. But this week's episode will shift away from Europe towards the Americas, focusing on two sets of elections that actually will take place within a few 24 to 48 hours of each other, that will take place at the opposite end of Americas at the start of October. So in a moment, we will look at a contest in Brazil, where far-right president Jair Bolsonaro is going up against former left-wing president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. But first, Sam, the largest French-speaking province of Canada is preparing to go to the polls, isn't it?
It is indeed, because the state of Quebec will be going to the polls on the 3rd of October to elect the 125 members of the National Assembly of Quebec in an election which, on the surface, doesn't seem to be particularly interesting because it seems to be a foregone conclusion that the current majority government, led by the Coalition Avenir Quebec, are set to not only retain that majority but increase it, is the headline expectation of the election. But under the surface, the story of Quebec politics seems to be very fascinating in this cycle because we seem to be having a churn up of the parties operating in the opposition. And I think that that'll be the focus of our preview of the election today, and I imagine will be the focus of the review as well. But headline, Premier François Legault, who will be fighting for a second term on Monday, having led his coalition Avenir Quebec to a landslide victory in 2018. And as we said, all indications seems to be that they're going to retain that majority. And he has led this party since it was founded. And one reason for the likelihood of another landslide victory is just how interesting the story is underneath them, because it's leading to quite a split in the opposition parties who are vying for second place. The main challenger being the Liberal Party, who are now led by Dominique Anglade, who has been leader since 2020. And despite sharing the same name as Justin Trudeau's Liberals, they are actually not affiliated with the National Liberal Party. And in Quebec is considered one of the traditional large parties, drawing on a lot of support from the Anglophones across the island of Montreal. And they have actually been in government several times in the history of Quebec. And then you also have the left-wing Quebec Solidaire, led by Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois, and the centre-left Parti Québécois, who don't have formal ties with the federal Bloc Québécois, but share similar ideological approaches in the region. And they're considered one of the big traditional party who draws on the support of the Francophones. And they have also had history of being in government in Quebec. The interesting story this time around, which is very new, is the Quebec Conservative Party, which is led by Éric Duhamel, who is poised to have a big impact in this election in terms of vote share, but might not be influential in terms of seats. And listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the first past the post electoral system. We have it here in the UK, Canada has it, and that seems to be what all eyes will be on in this electoral cycle, because due to the volume of parties vying for second place, it's likely that the Coalition Avenir Quebec will find it somewhat easier to retain its majority, even though, as I'm sure we'll discuss, its current premier, François Legault, is actually at an all-time low in his personal approval rating going into this election and looks set to emerge in 2 weeks' time with an increased majority. So hopefully that sums it up, Chern.
Yes, it does. And on one thought before we dive into the analysis, is that this sounds very familiar, doesn't it? If we just rewind our minds back to an election that took place in another province of Canada we covered, which is the Ontario elections, if you recall, we had a somewhat unpopular conservative leaning premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, but he got a second term with an increased majority because he got his party stayed about the same in terms of share of the vote, but went from 676 seats to 83 seats because the New Democrats got 24% of the vote and the Liberals got 24% of the vote. So it seems to be that clear split in the opposition has allowed in that case, the progressive conservatives to take a lot of seats that they did not take in 2018 that they subsequently took in this election in 2022. It does seem to be a very familiar story, isn't it, on that parallel? And secondly, I'm very grateful you mentioned first past the post because actually we could also be having a referendum in this election to abolish first past the post because in 2019 the Minister for Justice Sonia Lebel promised Bill C-39, which is an act to establish a new electoral system which aimed to replace first past the post with a mixed member proportional representation system. And for listeners who might not be aware, MMP is used in Scotland and it's in Germany, and it's really difficult for any parties under that system to gain an overall majority. However, They blamed the COVID-19 pandemic for altering the government's timetable and for not providing an alternative date for the referendum as such after it was due to be debated in the legislature. So I suppose, Sam, it's one of those where parties get into power through the system that they benefited from, get cold feet from they realizing they're going to be handsomely re-elected and then abandon electoral reform altogether. So your reaction to those first two points?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the comparison with Doug Ford in particular is particularly interesting because one of the few state premiers who actually has a lower approval rating than François Legault right now is indeed Doug Ford on 41% versus François Legault's 43% at the moment. And particularly on your point on electoral reform, I think you're absolutely right. I think it is one of those things where if you benefit from a system, you then start to doubt whether it's within your interest to change it. But I guess time will tell as to whether in this second term that we expect of the Coalition Avenir Quebec government, that they face significant pressure to return to that bill and put it forward potentially in the next Quebec election in 4 years' time.
Well, Sam, let's move on from the wider contours of Quebec and its politics. Let's talk about this election itself. So let's start with a question that we've often opened our election discussions on is, what have been the main campaign issues in this election? It seems to me, based on my initial read, both are issues that have always dominated Quebec politics, but also some new ones, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, as with quite a few elections, it depends on which party you look at as to what you think the main election issue is, because it's one of those things where I think the main contenders, Liberals, Coalition Avenir Quebec and the Conservatives, are all trying to suggest that the main issue for voters is something completely different. But I found an opinion poll, a quite recent opinion poll, which asked people what were the most important issues in this election to them. And you had cost of living, healthcare, language, climate, the pandemic, education, and then under that, immigration. And the reason I tell you about this poll is because if you look at the Coalition Avenir Quebec campaign, you would think that the number one issue in this election 100% is immigration. And yet you have that poll suggesting that immigration is right down there in the hierarchy, because François Legault has been talking about linking increased violence and extremism with immigration, and talking about how non-French immigration is a threat to national cohesion and threat to the continuation of the French language. Then you have the Conservative Party, who are talking pretty much all the time about COVID-19, freedom, liberalism, restriction of civil liberties, whilst you have the Liberal Party then talking about the cost of living, pressures on healthcare. So I find it interesting in this election that all the parties seem to be fighting on different things. So it's quite difficult to pin down what are the key cleavages in this election, because if you look at each party, you think it's something different. I don't know if you think that's a fair take, Chern.
I think not only the polls show something different, but I read a lot of the debate analysis on what the candidates talked about, and it seems to be they're bringing up very different issues as well. So for example, I have here climate change is one of the issues that was talked about on the debate so far. The opposition have accused the government of not doing enough on climate change. To give you an example, the government has a target of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 37.5% by 2030 compared to 1990 levels. And therefore, in order to reach that, they had proposed a 2020 target of 20%. Well, the reality is that the Quebec has only cut its emissions by 6%. So that is significantly less. And some of the left-wing Quebec Solidaire is proposing to do more and has published policies such as a tax on highly polluting cars, which was then rubbished by the François Legault and the Conservatives. It's a kind of classic economic versus environment kind of argument. And the Liberals themselves are proposing a 45% reduction to 1990 levels, Quebec Solidaire 55%. So that clearly is one issue that wasn't in the opinion polls, but clearly came out as a debating point. I have here as well is wider issues related to healthcare, which is not unsurprising, being the first election after the pandemic. The CAQ and the Conservative proposed an expansion of healthcare, and the Liberals have a commitment to get every Quebecer a family doctor, and issues on childcare as well. Again, another issue that arose because of the pandemic. You know, Francois Legault has boasted of his pledge to expand pre-K, but opponents have argued that the waiting list for public daycare is way too long. And the Liberals and the PQ have both had policies subsidizing daycare spots for all children. So it seems to be an election where there seems to be themes, but no one can quite agree there's no one dominant theme, isn't it?
No, exactly. And I think that's another thing that makes this election so interesting, because it's difficult to see where the motivation for voters is coming from for each political party. I mean, Chern, one of the key things in headline opinion polls for this election is that the traditional parties in Quebec of the Liberals and the Parti Québécois seem to be falling backwards and being replaced by either the governing party, Coalition Avenir Quebec, or indeed, in some areas, by the emerging Conservative Party. So what do you think could explain that fall?
Well, I would like to start off with a fantasy state. Until 2018, when was the last time in which a non-liberal, non-Parti Québec premier was in office?
I don't know.
The answer is 1970. From 1970 to 2018, power has alternated between the Liberals and Parti Québécois. So it's been a long dominant force in Quebec politics that has crumbled relatively recently. And I think the CAQ and François Legault, who himself is a former minister in a PQ government, I think a lot of his strength is from the Francophone vote. And you cannot ignore Francophone votes in a province like Quebec, where 80% of the population speaks French, which is very different compared to the rest of the other provinces in Canada. I've researched here from a Main Street poll, which is one of the big, where regularly polled the Quebec election, which showed that 44% of Francophone voters intended to vote for François Legault. Whereas the PQ has only drawn 11% support, which is phenomenally low for a party that was thought to be allied to be the major Francophone party. So it's very clear to me is that, again, a story we are seeing in very similar parts of many other countries is that the traditional parties have lost their base. And it seems that the Francophone votes have moved disproportionately in favor towards the CAQ as well.
If you look at the Liberals, the last time they came into government in 2014, and you look at where their seats came from, they picked up 15 seats from the Parti Québécois and 9 seats from the Coalition Avenir Quebec. So they've been traditionally reliant, when they're at their strongest, on picking up Francophone support as well. And I think what's happened in this election is the Francophone support has coalesced around either the Coalition Avenir Quebec or Quebec Solidaire, or indeed staying at the Parti Québécois, and they've been bleeding Anglophone support to the Conservative Party, so they've just been losing support in all directions, whereas their USP used to be that they had enough of an appeal to pick up Francophone support when they were at their strongest to propel them into government.
Yeah, I mean, the Liberals got, according to the Main Street poll, they were looking at about 51% of support on non-Francophones, but the reality is that that's a minority of the population, isn't it? So no matter how many votes you rack up there, it's kind of like those safe seats in that the Labour Party has, isn't it? No matter how much landslide victories they had, the safe seat, in the end, it makes a vote highly inefficient. And now the Liberals under Dominique Anglade has only got 8% of the Francophone vote. I mean, you can't win on those numbers, can you?
No, not at all. I mean, that's maybe a good opportunity to talk about where the Francophone vote has actually gone, because we've frequently talked about it as a given that the Coalition Avenir Quebec are going to win this election, and won big last time in 2018 as well. But prior to that, they were not really a big feature of Quebec politics. So where has that rise come from, and why have they been able to maintain it?
I think we saw, let me just rewind your mind back to 2011 in the federal election that took place in Quebec, because I think that was the first sign that the traditional structures of Quebec politics began to break down. Because in 2011, in the federal election, we saw the orange crush or the orange surge of the New Democrats take, virtually most of the seats in Quebec and propel Jack Layton to become the opposition party in that election, the only time the New Democrats were in second place in the federal level. And that was largely because I think one of the things we've seen in recent years is the fact that traditionally, both the Liberals and the Parti Québécois were able to get a lot of strength because this issue of sovereignty was a big issue in Quebec politics. So obviously, those that were in favor of sovereignty will vote for the Parti Québécois, and those against sovereignty will vote for the Liberals. However, I think the issue of sovereignty itself is no longer such a salient issue among voters or such a strong dividing line, and other issues have risen to the fore as well. So that's the first thing. The traditional battle lines have dissipated, and the major parties, the traditional parties, have been unable to adapt to that. And secondly, François Legault, clearly throughout his 4 years in government, has knows who his audience is, knows who what he needs to do to retain the majority Francophone support that propelled him into government in the first place. An example of that is Bill C-96, which is a controversial bill in Quebec, which saw the expansion of French language laws. Again, this is the interaction between immigration, because they are proposing that immigrants must be able to communicate with government agencies in French in 6 months, which is a short timetable to be bilingual in French, in any language for that matter. And it applies to businesses with 25 employees or over, compared to his previously of 50 employees or over. So there's an intersection of immigration with that, sovereignty as well, and the French language, which again, languages, as you said earlier, was one of the perennial issues in Quebec in politics. And I think as well, one more thing to add of what could explain François Legault's popularity is that, as we saw in the last federal election in 2021, Quebecers, particularly those outside of Montreal, are quite a socially conservative streak in them. The Bloc Québécois has moved very much to the populist right, as you mentioned in the last election. And early on in François Legault's tenure, he proposed an act called the Respecting the Laicity of the State, or known as Bill C-21. And that basically prohibits the wearing of religious symbols by certain public servants and contractors, including teachers and stuff like that. So I think that was very much targeting against religious groups such as Muslim, Jews, and Sikhs in particular. And I think that social conservative streaks, whilst being seen as a champion for the French language, despite Legault appointing himself as a minister for Anglophones, is really him cementing his status in French Quebec as a man who was help able to defend their rights.
I mean, I think basically François Legault has tapped into the key in every election that you have first past the post, which is if you can identify and utilize and be efficient with a sizable minority, you can win a raft of seats in a first past the post election because all you need to do is in a majority of ridings come first. You don't need a majority, and you don't need a huge statewide vote share, really, to be really efficient in an election. And I think he's managed to identify by being lukewarm on Quebec sovereignty in terms of increased devolution, but not as far as independence, and also tapping into those right-wing cultural issues. He's found, I think, a sizable niche in Quebec politics that has solidified the coalition avenue Quebec's electoral advantage over the other parties.
Yes, and I think he's also helped, as we said, we're saying this again for the many times, of having a divided opposition. Because, and an opposition where, frankly, if you think about it, you have Quebec Solidaire, which is a left-wing French political party. And then you have the Quebec Conservatives, which is almost a right-wing populist who draws more, a by citing more support for the Anglophones. I mean, how can these two parties form an electoral alliance to defeat the CAQ in a first past the post system? It just cannot happen, isn't it, Sam?
No, it can't. And I think the problem is that you've got so many parties vying for the rest of the vote that isn't hoovered up by Coalition Avenir Quebec, that it gives them even more of an electoral advantage. And that explains why they're projected to get even more seats than last time around, because there just isn't a volume of vote in each of the ridings to unseat the Coalition Avenir Quebec member of the National Assembly.
And one final thing on the traditional parties that I wanted to talk about was the leaders' approval ratings, because I think that this is a key component about this. And the reality is that, as we said, in 2014, the Liberals got into power by amassing enough support in retaining their base of Anglophone voters and gaining enough Francophone support to win the crucial seats, isn't it? Well, the problem is that it seems to me the leader is also a problem, because Dominique Anglade, although she's often credited with policy, seems she has a problem connecting with the electorate. Because in a Leger poll, a question asked was, which of the current opposition leaders do you prefer? She came last with 14% of the vote. And an even more damning poll said that when on view on who ran the best campaign, so this is including all five leaders, only 6% said that she had run the best campaign, and only 3% said that she won the debate on the 15th of September. So those are clear warning signs, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And I think we've said countless times in our 91 times of recording this podcast that if voters don't see you as a leader, even in a non-presidential system, being the elected leader of the country, or indeed in this case, of the state, then your party will not be successful, because that is the ultimate. That is one of the key things that voters assess when they go into the opinion polls beyond policy and ideology is, do I think you have the capability of leading, in this case, the state? And I think in Dominique Anglade's case, they have reached a firm no, which the Liberal Party are clearly trying to change, because in recent weeks, she has been absolutely front and center in the Liberal campaign, and they've been trying to make her the face of the campaign. It's not about policy, it's about her as a person trying to salvage some of that approval rating. But frankly, I think in this election, it was too little too late. And I think the Coalition Avenir Quebec has managed to hoover up enough support that even turning around her approval rating would be insufficient.
Indeed. So it seems to be problems with the Liberals, problems with the Parti Québécois, Quebec Solidaire kind of in the distance. But let's talk about the big unknown in this election, with the Quebec Conservatives. What has fueled the rise of the Conservative Party, who only got about 1% of the vote in 2018 and has never won a seat before in the Quebec National Assembly? So how has that happened?
I mean, COVID explains everything about this party, because one of their main campaign lines has been about the restriction of civil liberties from both lockdown restrictions and the vaccine mandate. And we saw earlier this year and towards the back end of last year the widespread protests across Canada that were mainly in Ottawa, but they did spread into other Canadian states over the vaccine mandate. The Freedom Convoy across Canada and the protests that came alongside that. And I think that explains a lot into why the Conservative Party found a lane in this election, because they tapped into that. And in fact, their campaign slogan, which in French is Libre chez nous, which translates roughly into free in our own home, is all about civil liberties and almost libertarian freedom fighting, if you will. And I think Éric Duhamel has tapped into that completely, and has now also been aligned with the new national conservative leader Pierre Poilievre in making that a tangible and nationally acceptable lane of conservatism in Canada. And I think if you combine that with some of the populist tendencies in the past of right-wing Quebecois political figures, and also the cultural issues you were talking about in what made the Coalition Avenir Quebec so popular originally, I think you can see how there is fertile ground for this kind of political approach. Now, that's not saying that they have enough support to win rafts of seats, because in first past the post that's quite challenging. But they are projected to get about 20% of the votes, which is nothing to scoff at, considering before this election they had not held a single seat in Quebec ever.
I just wonder, Sam, do you think that with the Quebec Conservatives that it's also a case of right-wing Anglophones? Because I do notice there's a slight bias support for towards the Anglophone community. And that is surprising to me, is because when you see a term in which the rights of Anglophones, particularly Bill C-96, as I talked about a bit earlier, being so very much attacked, you will often see the minority community, i.e. the Anglophone community, rally around probably the best shot of them getting into power, which is in this case dominate the Liberals, as given that they actually have seats there. Do you think a lot of these Anglophone voters think that, well, in this election the Liberals are going to lose anyway, so you might as well vote for a party that is more aligned to our interests as well? And I do note the Conservatives have a lesser are not as pro-Francophone as the CAQ.
Yeah, absolutely. And but I also think it comes down to Éric Duhamel as a leader as well, because he's an openly gay, former political advisor, member of a conservative think tank. He's a smooth operator as well. And as we said, leadership matters a lot and can be the reason why people flock around you, even if it's not necessarily the most politically beneficial thing to do.
Well, we will come back and produce another results review podcast. But predictions. I think I'll go first this time, since you've been going first the last few times. Not that I'm choosing to go first, because it's a lot easier to predict this one, which I'm sure the CAQ will win a second term with an increased majority. But I'm curious, Sam, who you think will come second. My guess is that in terms of votes, I won't be surprised if it's the Quebec Conservatives. Although I do know that will largely depend on turnout, and I could revise that prediction. But I think in seats, it'll still be the Liberals. What do you think?
I couldn't agree more. That was going to be my exact prediction. I think we'll end up with the Conservatives being narrowly ahead in terms of vote share, but the Liberals being significantly ahead in terms of seats.
Well, I'm afraid that could mean more conspiracy theories, and I'm sure we'll be covering conspiracy theories in a couple of minutes' time. But one thing's for certain, I'm sure Francois Legault will know that his approval ratings have been slowly moving downwards in this election. So winning this election could be only be step one of what could be a very much more difficult 4 years ahead. So welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. So one day on, and very much to the south of Quebec, on the 2nd of October, it's the first round of Brazil's presidential election in what is shaping up to be a divisive and consequential elections. So we have two main challenges: incumbent far-right president Jair Bolsonaro, who is running with former defense minister Walter Beto, and former chief of staff to the presidency, after previously falling out with Vice President Hamilton Mourão. He is challenged by the Brazil of Hope Alliance, which is led by former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who was president of Brazil from 2002 to 2010, of the Workers' Party, which is the main center-left political party in Brazil. His running mate is Geraldo Alckmin of the Socialist Party. Now, that's a familiar figure who will be familiar to Lula, because in his previously was the Social Democratic Party candidate in both 2018 and 2006, when he lost to a certain Lula da Silva. So I think it really shows you how the fault lines in Brazilian politics has evolved from one of, left-right traditional spectrum to one of populist versus more establishment figures. We should also mention there are two minor candidates, Ciro Gomes of the Democratic Labour Party and Simone Tebet of the Brazil Democratic Movement, who are also standing for the presidential election, but isn't really likely to get a large proportion of vote, and is likely to be a contest between Bolsonaro and Lula da Silva. We also should note that concurrently, there have also been elections to both the Chamber of Deputies and the Federal Senate itself. So, Sam, let's start off with the same question we asked in Quebec. What have been the main campaign issues in Brazil?
I mean, top of the list of campaign issues in Brazil really has been Jair Bolsonaro himself as an individual, with, of course, his party defending him and the opposition almost universally condemning him, both him and his family, because one thing that has been clear is that should he lose this presidential election, it's very likely that both himself and his sons will be facing potential criminal investigation for both COVID mismanagement and for illicit financial activity. So that has been a big campaign issue. Under that, I think another one has been political violence, because there has been an increase in physical political attacks on opposition members, to the point where actually you had Workers' Party activist Marcelo Alonso de Arruda murdered at his birthday party by a shooter who was shouting support for Bolsonaro at the time. And condemnation of those political violence episodes have been front and center in this campaign. And also allegations of electoral fraud, because Bolsonaro has been consistently preaching both prior to the 2018 election, since it, and now going into the 2022 election, that there are significant vulnerabilities in the Brazilian electoral system. As recently as July, he was telling a room of foreign diplomats that the electoral system is flawed and that votes are miscounted. And there is a real fear in Brazil about a repeat of January the 6th that we had in the United States, where there will be, if Jair Bolsonaro does indeed lose this election, that there will be a refusal to accept the result and potential echoes of the 1964 military coup in Brazil, because there are a number of military figures who were directly or indirectly involved in that coup in government currently with Jair Bolsonaro. So there have been conversations among international governments to sweep in immediately in the event that Bolsonaro is defeated to acknowledge Lula's victory in efforts to protect Brazilian democracy. So, not typical campaign issues internationally, not certainly not things, conventional things we've been talking about in recent weeks and months, but I think those really have been the main thrust of the campaign. Obviously, there are discussions around cost of living, on welfare, on climate, especially because deforestation has rapidly accelerated under Bolsonaro. In fact, the first half of 2022 was record-breaking in terms of the pace of deforestation. But I think underlying all of these things has been the character of Bolsonaro and the way his government has conducted itself.
Yeah, I think you covered it very, you covered it a lot of what Bolsonaro has been over the last 4 years. I should also add that famously during the COVID pandemic, he compared it to the flu, and he also questioned the role of the Supreme Court. I mean, after a record like that, apart from accusing the electoral system of rigged, and it does sound, you can see why he's got the nickname the Brazilian Trump, the Trump of the tropics, isn't it? And the potential ramifications post-vote could be just as frightening as what we saw post United States of their voting in the 2020 presidential election. You mentioned there about the concern, what a more generic concern of voters. I should add as well that food insecurity is one of those, because apparently food insecurity, according to a foundation study, is faced by one third of Brazilian families, which is quite an astonishing statistic for a country that's often seen as one of the BRICS, the most big industrializing economies. To see one third struggling with food insecurity really sums up the cost of living problem that many Brazilian families are facing. And for a right-wing political candidate, Bolsonaro himself has responded by increasing social spending, which is not often you see in right-wing political candidates, including cutting fuel tax and an aid payment to the country's poorest of 120 million cash payments to 20 million families. So very much, again, that Trump playbook of on very right, far right in terms of in terms of social issues, on institutions, and very much against the establishment, but on the economic side could be quite left wing, isn't it?
Yeah, precisely. And I think you're absolutely right for bringing up those issues. But I think generally the campaign has, as I said, been dominated by the figure of Bolsonaro. And I think it's important for us to discuss where that came from, because Bolsonaro really did emerge from relative unknown in terms of being at the top of Brazilian politics to being the president in 2018. And where did that come from, and why Do we now all assume that he is at real risk of losing that just 4 years on?
Well, let's just rewind just before the 2018 election to look over the last term between 2014 and 2018. Brazil in 2014 re-elected its first female president in Dilma Rousseff, who was Lula da Silva's chief of staff and energy minister. But soon after that, her government fell very much in scandal over something called Operation Car Wash, which is basically, and this could explain a lot of why Brazilians were very much frustrated with politicians and many high ranking of the establishment. And because Operation Car Wash set out to root out corruption, was basically root out corruption among high ranking Latin America political and business leaders, very much in Brazil's case relating to Petrobras, which is a state oil company. It did also ensnare Lula da Silva, but we'll come to him in a minute. But the main impact of that was to ensnare President Dilma Rousseff herself, who was subsequently impeached and removed as president. And we had Michel Temer, her vice president, become president for a short period of time. And this all was taking place in a rising discontent with stagnating standards of living, having seen great progress made under Lula da Silva. So we saw it was stagnation in Brazilian politics. And at the same time, I think as well, is that don't forget, in that time from 2014, 2018, Brazil held both the World Cup and the Rio Olympics, both very expensive, although it promoted Brazil to the world, but it's still very costly as well. And I wonder if people felt during that time is why are we spending so much money on these international sporting events when it should be spent on helping on solving some of the social problems in Brazil. So I think all those frustration in the political elite, the stagnating living conditions, and yet it seems as warped policy priorities compared to the people could help fuel the rise of Bolsonaro, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I think corruption is definitely one of the key reasons Bolsonaro emerged, because he emerged as a critic of the entire political establishment. And I think what illustrated that even more is that Fernando Haddad, who was the candidate of the Workers' Party going into the 2018 election, was not particularly reading the room on those issues, because he repeatedly stated in the campaign that Dilma Rousseff's impeachment and the imprisonment of Luiz Lula da Silva were illegitimate. And I think in that context, when you had someone basically saying, we have rife corruption in Brazil, which has been illustrated by Operation Car Wash, which led to 159 convictions across 11 countries, and most significantly in Brazil, it's very difficult to argue that corruption wasn't rife through the heart of government, because it went all the way from the presidency down through both chambers of parliament as well. So I think you had a significant issue, and Bolsonaro was able to effectively tap into that.
And I think one understated reason of how Bolsonaro was able to tap into support is his popularity among evangelical Christians, who make up almost about one third of the country's population. And in 2018, he secured around 70% of these votes. So it's quite a sizable chunk. And as a result, over the 4 years, he rewarded them by giving them key ministerial positions, as well as appointing an evangelical Supreme Court judge. Whereas Lula da Silva, on the other hand, has faced pushback from many evangelicals over remarks he made earlier to say that abortion should be viewed as a public health issue, it's a religious one. Bolsonaro, on the other hand, has stressed his commitment to ensure that most abortions remain illegal in Brazil. And I would like to also point out that he's also used his wife, particularly savvily as well, Michelle de Paula, who is the current First Lady of Brazil. And she is a very evangelical, she's been actively supporting her husband at rallies and is an evangelical herself. So I think all these subtle hints have also been an underrated story of how Bolsonaro was able to tap into a group of voters who might not have necessarily been activated in the past to now, who now has been really energized by a president who has finally been advocating their views.
So given all that, why are we therefore thinking that this election is likely to produce a result that sees Jair Bolsonaro leaving office?
Well, I think it's purely because he's up against Lula da Silva, Now, theoretically, if you use the past playbook, he was part of the establishment. He was ensnared in the Operation Car Wash himself. He faced corrupt. He was found guilty of corruption charges, which were subsequently overturned by the Supreme Court on a technicality, and because they argued that the right to a fair trial being compromised by a and he, there was a biased judge as well. So, I think and Bolsonaro. I think this led criticism of Bolsonaro to the Supreme Court because he acknowledged the power that Lula had. And Lula drew his power very much from the nostalgia that Brazilians had from 2003 to 2010 when he was president. He still is Brazil's one of Brazil's most popular leaders, having led millions of his country counterparts out of poverty itself. And it's, I suspect, nostalgia for that good time is what is propelling him to be the front runner for this presidential candidate. And therein lies the key problem with Bolsonaro is that I do not think that over his tenure, he subsequently improved the living standards of the ordinary Brazilians to a sufficient degree. It is very much like I'm reminded of Ronald Reagan's famous saying in 1980 is, are you better off than you were in 4 years ago? And Brazilians fundamentally are not. And I think that could be, and given we're presented with the architect of who brought them the greatest prosperity, I think that's why Bolsonaro is heading out of office. What do you think, Sam?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think it cannot be understated that Lula as a figure is a very effective candidate to put up against someone like Bolsonaro because, yes, they were embroiled in Operation Car Wash. He was and still remains one of the most popular Brazilian politicians of all time. And I think that is one of the key reasons why he's able to combat Bolsonaro so effectively. I think another reason is just in terms of who his running mate is, because one other reason why Lula has been able to navigate this election quite well is that they've basically united all of the significant parts of the opposition around one banner, which was probably always going to be instrumental in ousting Bolsonaro because Bolsonaro is very unlikely to win on the first ballot. So you will progress, if you don't, you will together progress to a second ballot. And if there were two sizable opposition blocs going into this election, whichever one made it to the second ballot, some members of the support for the other opposition party that was knocked out would not come across because you've spent an entire election campaign attacking each other, calling them out for being not right for the country, the wrong ideological promises. Whereas in this case, that's not going to happen because the sizable opposition to Lula, which would have been the Social Democratic Party, which is a right-wing party in Brazil, is actually part of the fold and on the ticket. So you're capturing that vote from the beginning, you're being united from the beginning. Yes, you have two other minor candidates who are polling about 6 or 7%, but you have the possibility of winning this election in the first round because of how united an opposition you're presented. And I think that has been key as well because Bolsonaro knows he's really up against it because of the united opposition that's being presented in front of him.
Yeah, and I can kind of see this stoking of electoral rigged electoral system as very much him trying to A, motivate his voters to come out, which we know these kind of voters are much more low salient voters, much more low salient voters to vote in elections. So that's very much that, and also potentially preparing in case he loses, if possible somehow remaining in government in some way, shape, or form past election as well. And I think we should note, or just a quick comment on the Social Democratic Party, it being somewhat of a center-center-right party, is that A, it's a bit like Portugal, isn't it? Where they also have a center-center-right party called the Social Democratic Party. But I find it even more amazing that Bolsonaro himself is leader of the Liberal Party. So clearly the traditional center-left to right political names you
Yeah.
associate, how they fall, do not apply in Brazil, is it?
No. And I think the other thing I was going to comment on, particularly Geraldo Alckmin, who is the vice presidential nominee, is one of the areas geographically that the Workers' Party have struggled is in the south of Brazil and São Paulo. Well, Geraldo Alckmin was the former governor of São Paulo, and him and his party have been traditionally quite strong in that area. So bringing in that into the fold is also adding a geographic benefit because you're trying to plug the gaps where the Worker Party would have struggled with people who are traditionally popular in that area, and that could prove to work in Lula's benefit as well.
I totally agree with you. Actually, before we turn to our overall prediction, and I think the prediction will be centered on will it take Lula one round or two rounds? Which do you think is a key voter bloc to watch in this election, in your opinion? And that will probably shape, in your opinion, whether Lula can make it one round or two.
Yeah, well, I think it does depend on how many rounds it is, because if it goes to two rounds, the voter bloc I'd be really paying attention to is the 14, 15% of the electorate who actually voted for two other minor candidates in this election. Because the question is, do they turn out at all? And if they do they vote for Lula or do they fall into the Bolsonaro camp? Because that will be key. Because I think if I were a Lula supporter in Brazil, I would feel much more comfortable with Lula winning in the first round, because the last time the Brazilian election went to a second round, Bolsonaro ended up president. And I think there is a route for Bolsonaro to win in the second round, if indeed it does get there. But for the first round, I would be watching that geographic location, the São Paulo area, because do they fall in behind the Lula ticket, even though they haven't traditionally been Workers' Party supporters? Or are they attracted enough by the fact that Geraldo Alckmin is there to moderate the platform, to provide a different ideological outlook? Because if Lula can't pick up significant amounts of the vote in São Paulo, one, he has no chance of winning in the first round, because quite a significant amount of Brazil's population resides in that area. And two, he might be at risk of not being able to pick up enough of it, even going into the second round. If they're not convinced that Lula is going to be moderated enough by his VP running mate, then they could have a problem. So that's what I'll be looking at. What about you, Chen?
Yeah, I think, it was very strategic to turn to a former governor of São Paulo, Geraldo Alckmin. And not only that, he's been governor quite a few times. So in terms of winning votes in São Paulo, theoretically in the past, he's done it before. Can he do it on the national level with Bolsonaro? I think remains to be the question. I think for me, one thing I would really watch is the performance in the North of Brazil. Now, the Northeast is a traditional Workers' Party stronghold. But the state in which I'm most curious about is the rest of the North outside the Northeast. In 2014, it voted 58% 42 to Dilma Rousseff. And in 2018, that went 55-45 to Bolsonaro. So it swung very heavily towards Bolsonaro 4 years for in from 2014 to 2018. And the reason why I'm watching that area is because this is the area of the Amazonas where you're really pitting those people who have directly benefited from President Bolsonaro's lax or loosening of deforestation regulation and really environmental agencies seeing staffing and budget cuts against the indigenous vote, in which has been fundamentally attached to the forest and seeing their livelihood go away. I think for me, I'll be very interested to see in that state who wins out. It might not be the most populous area in terms of, certainly compared to São Paulo, there are very few people there. I think for me personally, I think seeing that contest between people who the developers who have directly benefited from the indigenous people who have a direct stake in it, and we have seen the impact of indigenous votes in other parts of South America. I think to me that would be very interesting to watch.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you bring up other candidates in South America, because I think one thing that Lula could take some pause for confidence from is that there have been other successful left-wing leaders across South America who've won elections in contexts which it seemed the odds were against them. And he could take some confidence from the fact that when push comes to shove against some unpopular populist figures, people have been capable of coalescing around the left, even if they traditionally didn't come from a left-wing tradition ideologically.
Yeah, and I think another thing to note as well is that And I mentioned earlier that Bolsonaro drew a lot of his support from evangelicals, if you recall, in the last election. I wonder how evangelical women are likely to respond, because Bolsonaro himself has come across as somewhat misogynistic. Now, it didn't appear to hurt Trump in the 2020 election, but I'm curious to see whether it will hurt Bolsonaro, because not only potentially will you be evaluated, like say, on abortion, LGBT rights, but at the end, as Bill Clinton famously said, is the economy stupid? So I wonder if evangelicals will A, vote in the same number as they did in 2018, or will they be put off by his misogynistic statements or his and the overall performance of the economy and the pandemic, and not vote for him, which could be the alternative route. Therefore, even though he may get the same percentage in terms of raw vote margin, he may not. So I think that's the other consideration as well.
I mean, time is fast running out, Chern. If I were to ask you to predict one, the result, and two, how many rounds it will take, where's your mind at?
I don't think he can make it in one round. Traditionally, Brazilian elections, even in 2010, when Dilma Rousseff won a first term, and very much the polls had did at that point thought that she would do it in one round, failed to do it in one round. I think we could see it, Lula, do it in two rounds. Potentially, I've seen about 45, 46% share of the vote right in the first round, which would put him in very good position to secure even a minority of the vote from the third and fourth place candidates to make it into the to become president after the 30th October, which is the runoff date. What about you, Sam?
See, I actually think that Lula might just edge it in the first round. Opinion polls have the jury is out in opinion polls at the moment, suggesting that Lula might win somewhere between 47, 48, 49, 50% of the vote, somewhere either just making it in the first round or just falling short. But I'm inclined to believe that he might just make it because I think ultimately the there might be 1 or 2% of the people choosing to support the minor candidates who, when push comes to shove on election day, might think, is the risk too great that if I don't elect Lula in this first round, we get Bolsonaro again, that I'm just not prepared to take that risk and vote for a minor party? And that's not suggesting that, because I think, as I said before, I think a key issue for Lula is that those third party candidates, those third party supporters, might actually not vote for either of them in the second round. I think there will be enough people who vote for third party candidates who think, actually, I don't want to risk us getting Bolsonaro again, and I don't trust the rest of my peers in who are voting for these third party candidates to come across to Lula when push comes to shove, that I feel like I need to fall in behind Lula on election day in the first round. So that I think Lula might just edge it. And when I say just edge it, I mean he might even get 50.5% of the vote. That close.
Well, just my comment on that, I think it's really fascinating. I would love to see more analysis after the results. Is that in an election which is so divided between the far right and the left, and yet you still are adamant of voting for a third or fourth party candidate who have nowhere near chance of winning? I think understanding the motivations why would be very interesting. And understanding the motivations why, I think, could hold the key to who wins in the second round.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine who's from Brazil, who was saying that their biggest push now, because they're Lula supporters, their biggest push is to try and drain the support of the third party candidates because they just do not trust that the majority of people voting for third party candidates will actually come across to Lula at the end of October, if indeed it goes to a second round. So they're determined to end this in one, and let's see if they're successful in doing so.
Well, your friends in Brazil will not have long more to go before they find out whether they've been successful in electing Lula in one or two rounds. Do you see a world in which Bolsonaro will get elected, by the way?
I think if this goes to a second round, I can see a Bolsonaro victory emerging because I think people will just doubt the strength of the Lula coalition if they weren't even able to amass 50% in the first round. And particularly if Lula polls somewhere like 43, 44, 45, getting that extra 5% could be quite difficult because you might stand and think, well, if you couldn't get 50% if you couldn't get that extra 5% in the first round, where's it going to come from? Because it's not going to come from Bolsonaro. So you are relying on at least one of the third party candidates, all of them coming into your camp. And I don't know if you can rely on that, but I'd say that Lula has about a 75% chance of winning this election, maybe even higher, whatever round, however many rounds it takes. But I do think there is a chance. There is a lane for Bolsonaro. It's narrow, but he's navigated it before.
Well, I'm sure many people, when you hear the word 75%, will have a slight shiver down your spine, because that was exactly the 538 prediction in the 2016 election of Hillary Clinton's winning probability. So hopefully, I suspect for many left-wing supporters, lightning doesn't strike twice. But as they say famously, time will tell. But for now, that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again next week when we'll be reviewing the elections in Italy and the start of a very busy series of elections in October and November. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at @ballot_tour. And do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. My name is Chen Han, and to all Italians, please go out and vote. But until next time, we'll speak to you soon.